Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 10th of March, these are our main stories. There's been a second mass kidnapping at a school in Nigeria as security forces continue their search for almost 300 students abducted on Thursday. Pope Francis has suggested Ukraine should consider itself defeated and negotiate with Russia to end the war. Irish voters reject the government's attempt to broaden the definition of family and alter language on the role of women in the country's constitution. Also in this podcast, an investigation is underway in Indonesia after two pilots fell asleep at the controls for almost half an hour, causing their plane to drift off course. And the Hollywood Awards you wouldn't want to win.
And the winner of the Razzie Award is...
We'll reveal the worst film of the year. First, just days after almost 300 students were taken in Nigeria's Kaduna state, there's been another kidnapping, this time at a school in the northwestern state of Sokoto. According to Nigerian officials, armed men stormed the school, taking hostage 15 students and 4 women. Meanwhile, Kaduna's state governor has told BBC News at least 28 of the school children kidnapped on Thursday have managed to escape. It isn't yet clear who the captors are. Our West Africa correspondent Myoni Jones is in Borno State in Maiduguri, where more than 200 people were taken captive last weekend.
Details are still emerging. We just know that it happened very early in the morning. The gunmen came into a town called Gada in Sokoto, fired in the air, and as they were leaving, they spotted these 15 students running into their dormitories and decided to take them away. And obviously this is gaining a lot of attention because it's the third abduction involving children in just over a week here in northern Nigeria. First, some internally displaced children and women were abducted from just outside their camp as they were gathering firewood. It's suspected that that was carried out by Boko Haram fighters. Then there was an attack on Thursday. Then there was this one in Sokoto.
You mentioned there have been three incidents just in a few days. Does anyone have any idea why we've seen this spate of kidnappings? Obviously, it's something that's happened before, but that's an awful lot of people who've been caught up in it this week.
Absolutely, particularly because we hadn't seen mass kidnappings involving school children, at least since 2021, where there were a spate of kidnappings in the area of Kaduna and Katsina in the northwest. Nobody's entirely sure why it's happening again this time. Some are saying it might be because Ramadan is coming up, and previous abductees have said that around that period they were taken to help the armed gangs and the terror groups that have been active across northern Nigeria. They were abducted to help cook and do other menial tasks in their camps in the forests. Another suggestion that's been made by some analysts is that the economy in Nigeria is performing particularly poorly. These gangs have, over the last few years, managed to exist by extorting local farmers. Those farmers haven't made a lot of money recently, partly because of the insecurity. So perhaps they're turning to mass kidnapping of children because they know that the publicity that comes around them puts pressure on the government to pay hefty ransoms for the return of the students. But it has to be said, the government's always denied paying ransoms for the return of people who've been abducted.
Miley Jones with me from Maiduguri. Now, getting food into Gaza has become progressively more dangerous and difficult since the start of the war there, with Israel imposing restrictions on land deliveries. Meanwhile, the UN says a quarter of Gaza's population is on the brink of famine, with children starving to death. The United States plans to get aid to Gaza from the sea, but the pier it's building will take around 2 months. The European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, says she hopes a new maritime corridor to Gaza could begin operating this weekend. Open Arms is a Spanish vessel currently in the Cypriot port of Larnaca, hoping to set sail soon, carrying 200 tons of food aid. The Spanish charity that's running this mission, also called Open Arms, is working in tandem with the US charity World Central Kitchen. My colleague Nuala McGovern spoke to the co-founder of Open Arms, Esther Camps, from Cyprus.
We expect to do it as soon as possible. We do not have an exact timing because it depends on many factors, not only us, but Cyprus and many other factors that are not in our hands right now.
I understand. But are you thinking this weekend, like potentially today or tomorrow?
We hope that this weekend we can leave.
Yes.
At least we are going to be ready to leave this weekend.
What about Israel? Have they agreed?
As far as we know, yes. We hope that the corridor is open soon.
And what about Hamas?
Well, we know that we are going into a place in war. We are not afraid of our security. We think we can do it. That's why we are here. The mission is to bring food, humanitarian aid, that it's very, very, very needed over there. The people is starving. We are mostly afraid of not reaching it, not getting over there and make this food reach the people.
I understand
that
your mission, but I did also see your partner, Mr. Camp, saying that he was not concerned at all about security. And I just wonder why that is when we have heard and seen the reports of what it can be like on the ground or coming close to the vicinity with Gaza?
Well, first of all, if we were concerned about security, we wouldn't be here enduring this kind of mission. We know that it's risky. We know that there is a lot of problems, but we have this blessing of Cyprus. Yesterday, Ursula von der Leyen also speak about this mission. So we have many eyes on us. Yeah, we know that it's risky, but we are going to try it anyway in order that later other actors can join this mission and make it bigger because it's also a small mission. No, we are trying to get 200 pallets. It's around 200 tons of aid.
And with that 200 tons, is that all food aid?
Yeah.
Some would say that it may not have a huge impact because of those figures. It's hard to decipher exactly how many people that might feed. Some estimates are maybe 300,000 people for one day.
Exactly. It's, as I was saying, it's a drop of water into the ocean.
So you see it as symbolic.
Tell me. Exactly.
There are no functioning ports in Gaza. How are you going to get that food to the people who need it?
Yeah, these details we must keep confidential by now to ensure the success of the mission. We are not allowed to give any information about this yet.
Tell me about your role in the coming days.
I am an able seaman, but I will also be coordinating the mission from on board. And I will be the contact person also on our team inland, in Larnaca, even in Spain, and the authorities here in Cyprus.
So this could be a risky mission for you personally.
Exactly. In fact, it is.
Do you have any pause about that? Any qualms, concerns?
I am really positive. If you asked me like 2 weeks ago, I would tell you that this mission was impossible. But now I only think that it will be difficult. It will be challenging. But I'm convinced that it is going to be a successful mission. We are going to open this maritime corridor. And we are doing our best to try.
Esther Camps on board the vessel Open Arms, talking to my colleague Nuala McGovern. Pope Francis has suggested that Ukraine should have what he called the courage of the white flag and negotiate an end to the war against invading Russian forces. He made these comments in an interview which was recorded last month with the Swiss broadcaster RSI. Here's Danny Eberhardt.
With this interview, Pope Francis has entered contentious ground. He's asked in a video clip about Ukraine whether surrendering was a courageous thing or a legitimization of the law of the strongest. The pontiff, in his response, said that when, in his words, you see you are defeated, you have to have the courage to negotiate. Timely negotiations could avoid, he suggested, a situation where you end up in a worse place despite more deaths. War, he argued, requires two parties and is always a defeat, a human one, not a geographical one. Ukraine has not responded so far, but Kyiv will not welcome the Pope's intercession. President Zelensky rejects talk he considers defeatist, insisting his nation will beat the Russian aggressors.
In what's thought to be a world first, doctors here in London have successfully trialled a new approach to treating one of the most aggressive forms of brain cancer. People diagnosed with glioblastoma typically don't survive for more than 9 months, at least not until now. This breakthrough involved using drugs that prompt the immune system to target the tumour. The beneficiary of the new treatment was a 41-year-old Englishman called Ben Trotman, who's still doing well almost a year and a half after surgery. My colleague Gabriel Gatehouse spoke to Dr. Paul Mulholland from University College Hospital in London, who led the trial.
Ben came into the trial and the idea was that he'd have a biopsy and then the immunotherapy and then he'd go for more surgery. We gave him the immunotherapy and he developed a really severe headache. So severe, we ended up admitting him for 4 or 5 days. Now, oddly enough, it was quite pleasing that he's got this massive headache because it meant that there was something happening, that the immune system was going into the brain and doing something. So his white cells were activated and they then found this inflammatory process in his brain, which is the tumour, and they all started congregating there. We didn't do any more surgery. We knew he had active disease there. So we said we'll go back to the standard treatment of having radiotherapy and chemotherapy. And then 3 months after the radiotherapy, we did a scan and it showed that he had no evidence of high-grade disease.
Well, that's incredible and great news for him. How do you know it was the immunotherapy that did it and not the radiotherapy and the chemotherapy?
It's very unusual to see such a response. It's just very atypical.
Have you tried it on other patients?
The same immunotherapy, we gave it in the study after the radiotherapy, and the trial did not show a survival advantage. It did not work if you give it after the radiotherapy.
This form of brain cancer, glioblastoma, is incredibly aggressive. The apparent success of the treatment that you gave to Ben, what are the implications for others?
We had the trial open and unfortunately did not get recruitment, so we had to terminate the study.
Why did you not get recruits?
I think that it's a challenge to change standard practice, which is surgery, radiotherapy and chemotherapy. And we'd like the opportunity to have more trials. We think that all patients should have an opportunity to enter a trial if they're well enough and if they want to.
Can we just go back to patient Ben? What are his prospects? Do we know that it's gone, that it's not going to come back?
No, we don't know. He knows that it could come back at any time. But his prospects are, I think, better than they were. He had active disease, which is not there now. And we hope that he just stays as well as he is.
Brain cancer specialist Dr. Paul Mulholland with Gabriel Gatehouse. And still to come.
They will still be Asian elephants, but they will look and behave such that they can live at minus 40 degrees in the wintertime for months on end.
A breakthrough in the quest to resurrect the woolly mammoth. Ireland's Prime Minister Leo Varadkar has admitted defeat in the country's referendum on family and care. One change sought to alter the definition of family. The other wanted to remove a reference to women in the home. Here's Julian Fowler.
The Irish government's intention was to change two clauses of the constitution, which was written in 1937. One was to expand the definition of family to include unmarried couples and single-parent families. The other was to update the so-called women in the home clause. The Constitution currently says that mothers should not have to go out into the workplace to the neglect of their duties in the home, which supporters of the change argued was sexist and outdated. However, the wording on the ballot papers raised concerns over care, disability and taxation. The Irish Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, said it was clear both amendments had been defeated comprehensively on a respectable turnout, and he accepted responsibility for the result on behalf of his government.
The Pacific Ocean is vast, but control of its waters is mostly down to the many tiny island nations dotted around it with massive zones of economic control. Some years ago, many such Pacific nations signed up to a global initiative to protect 30% of the ocean by 2030. One nation, Palau, went a lot further than that. But as the BBC's Frey Lindsay has been finding out, some on the islands say that was a mistake.
I'm on board the National Geographic Society research vessel, the Argo, off the coast of Palau. Victor Nesta and Dr. Piero Biondi, researchers with the Palau International Coral Reef Centre, are collecting water samples. Once the seawater is collected, it's put in a special filtering device to extract all the biological information it can. That way it measures the biodiversity of the thousands of metres of ocean below us. It's called environmental, or eDNA.
So basically it's all the organic particles that in this case we can find in the water that we collect. So in our case we focus on fish or vertebrates in general.
The Argo is here in the waters around Palau at the request of the Palauan government. They've been asked to assess the biodiversity around the waters in Palau's EEZ, or Exclusive Economic Zone. The actual landmass of Palau is quite small, but because it's an archipelago and EEZ waters extend for hundreds of kilometres around each island, it adds up to an area of ocean around the size of France. Now, Palau made headlines and won global acclaim in 2015 when it agreed to create a maritime sanctuary in 80% of these waters. Lucas Isseal is a marine scientist with the Palauan Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Environment.
We wanted to do conservation. We thought it was important for not only Palauans now, but, you know, our younger generations. One of the other concerns was that the current fishery that was happening within the EEZ then was predominantly foreign. We felt that we weren't capturing the value of the fishery that we thought we deserved.
The current president, Sarangel Whips Jr., though, says this plan hasn't worked out, and he's pushing to open up more of Palau's waters to commercial use.
What we've been working on is how do we 100% manage our oceans in the most effective way to optimize those resources for the sustainable use and for the people. So the size of the sanctuary, to me, is just a number. It should be relevant. That's really what's important. What's the right size, and how does it really, at the end of the day, provide for the economic needs of the local people, but at the same time, ensure that we can continue to fish for generations to come?
When it came out that President Whips was considering rolling back this much-fated 80% marine sanctuary, he received backlash from within Palau and all around the world. But he says Palau is being unfairly singled out to be a leader on conservation when other, much larger countries could be doing more themselves.
Frey Lindsay reporting. Aviation authorities in Indonesia are investigating an incident in which both the pilot and the co-pilot of a plane fell asleep during a flight. The 157 passengers and crew on board were unaware of what was happening as the plane drifted off its flight path. Celia Hatton has the story.
The episode involving two sleeping pilots took place during a domestic Batik Air flight in late January on a routine journey from southeast Sulawesi province to the capital, Jakarta. The plane's pilot had originally requested permission from his co-pilot to rest, but the second in command also then fell asleep at the controls. Both pilots slept for approximately 28 minutes of the more than two-hour journey. Their failure to guide the plane led it to go off course, though no one was harmed and it landed normally. Indonesia's Transportation Safety Committee noted the co-pilot was a new father to one-month-old twins and had not been sleeping well at home.
Next to Pakistan, and for the second time, Asif Ali Zardari is the country's president. He was voted in decisively by national and provincial lawmakers following recent parliamentary elections, which were marred by accusations of voting irregularities. Mr. Zardari is the widower of the assassinated former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Ethirajan told me more about him.
Many people in Pakistan would describe him as someone who's a master of reconciliation, who can deal with all the political parties and then bring about some sort of agreement. And that is the hope for many people in Pakistan at this point, because the country is going through a very difficult phase, both in terms of political as well as economical. What especially the ruling coalition, want is to build a consensus among the political parties. Now, we had the prime minister election last week. Shehbaz Sharif from the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz faction was elected, now the president. So everyone hopes that the next step will be look forward to what Pakistan can do. As you know, Zardari was the husband of the slain Premier Benazir Bhutto. He had spent a lot of time in jail on various corruption charges before, but he was always described as someone who can always wriggle out of a very difficult situation and then, you know, reach a comfortable position. And because of his extensive connections, there is a lot of hope.
And a master of reconciliation is what Pakistan needs right now, politically, economically. Can he sort any of this stuff out?
That's the hope, but the challenges are huge. We're talking about, you know, the inflation running around 22-23%. And now Pakistan has to go to the IMF for another set of loans. They need $5 to $6 billion. Their foreign exchange currency reserves are around $7 billion, but not enough. But what this also means is structural reforms. That means the prices of gas and electricity can go up. That means that can trigger more public anger, fix the economy. That is the major thing. And second is, of course, the increasing militant attacks in the north, particularly by Tehrik-e-Taliban, which wants to impose a Sharia law in Pakistan.
And is there any optimism among ordinary people in Pakistan at the moment? Does anyone think that the country's turning a corner and that the, you know, the solution is not too far away?
If you ask supporters of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan, who's currently in jail on a corruption conviction, they would say that the mandate was stolen. Their party, it won the highest number of seats, though it did not get majority. What the party says is that in many places, vote rigging was taking on. So there is a huge divide. On the other hand, Pakistan is a nuclear-armed country, and that's a country of 240 million people. Without consensus, if people are going to go to the streets against these huge structural reforms, that is why they hope Zardari can bring all these parties together.
Anbarasan Etharajan with me. Woolly mammoths were extinct 4,000 years ago, so you might think that was a pretty definitive end to the species. But scientists from a biotech firm said they've made a breakthrough in their attempt to resurrect these prehistoric animals. For the first time, they've created stem cells from Asian elephants, the mammoth's closest living relative. It's hoped this so-called de-extinction project could lead to new ways to protect endangered species. Professor George Church co-founded the company behind all this, Colossal Biosciences.
Many elephant species and even elephant genera have interbred over the years. And so this is just another example of a hybrid. This will be close enough to an Asian elephant that we really are helping that endangered species by providing them with the ability to live in a broader set of climates away from the challenge of living in dense human populated areas, mostly in Asia.
So this process will actually help existing elephants take on some of the characteristics of woolly mammoths.
That's our hope, is that they will still be Asian elephants, but they will look and behave such that they can live at minus 40 degrees in the wintertime for months on end.
The question is, why are you actually doing this? What's the reason behind this project?
So there's a number. One is the endangered species, very charismatic species. All elephants are endangered. Number two is the environment of the Arctic is in danger, and there's lots of carbon at risk, and the elephants were among the herbivores that humans drove to extinction 10 to 4,000 years ago, and they kept it in a grassland which was much more vibrant, better at sequestering carbon and keeping it sequestered. So conservation technology in general.
And the idea of trying to revive extinct animals has been controversial in the past. What's your view on that?
Usually it's presented as an either or. Either we can do conservation and endangered species, or we can do extinct. In this case, we can do both because the DNA that we're getting for the ancient species could help the modern species to survive by allowing them to move further away from human population centers.
Is this a new species, and does it need a name like a mammophant or an elemoth? We were just thinking about that.
I don't think it's a new species. These elephants interbred already, which is one of the species definitions. It will be breedable with Asian elephants, almost certainly.
And how long might it be before we see a workable, real-life elemoth, mammophant, whatever you want to call it?
The CEO set a challenge of 6 years about 2 years ago, so it's another 4 years due, and we're still on track now. getting these stem cells, which is the event today that we're celebrating, that was an unknown. But now we've got that. That opens the gates for all sorts of things that have been piling up that we wanted to do, like editing the genome. So now we can do that.
Professor George Church from Colossal Biosciences. It's the antidote to the Oscars later today, the Golden Raspberry Awards, or the Razzies, which celebrate Hollywood's biggest cinematic flops. This year's main winner or victim is a horror film based on a much-beloved fictional bear.
You should be close now.
We're not going to find them.
We will. Pooh, Piglet, Eeyore, we were friends for many years.
That's from Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, shortly before Christopher Robin discovers that his childhood friends have gone feral in the woods. The film scored only a 3% rating on film review website Rotten Tomatoes. More now from our culture reporter, Charlotte Gallagher.
When you look at the reviews, it probably would be quicker to tell you what was right with the film. So the critics say lack of humour, poor acting, poor screenplay, easily forgettable. One said that the scenes are so poorly lit they couldn't actually see what was going on at times because it was so dark. However, it cost $100,000 to make this film and it actually made $5.2 million. So it did well for a very small budget. That's an incredibly small budget for a film. A lot of people like this film, and actually the publicity from the Razzies might mean more people see it as well.
But it didn't just pick up Worst Picture.
No, it really did sweep the board. So obviously you said Worst Picture, Worst Remake, Rip-off or Sequel, Worst Director, Worst Screenplay and Worst On-Screen Couple. That went to Pooh and Piglet.
This hasn't put off the makers of the film, though, because they're going for gold. They're going for a sequel.
You can actually see it in cinemas this month. They've spent loads more money on this film as well because the first one did so well. So the first film, they spent about $700 on Winnie the Pooh's costume and the prosthetics. This film, they've spent $20,000.
Wow.
So the prosthetics and the costumes were criticised in the first one. So he's hoping the filmmakers have their fingers crossed they'll get better reviews for the second. But I suppose they're laughing all the way to the bank, aren't they?
So Winnie the Pooh, not very good. Who were the other victims or winners? How should we put it?
A real mention for poor old Megan Fox. She won Worst Actress and Worst Supporting Actress for Johnny and Clyde and the fourth Expendables. John Voight, an Oscar winner, he won Worst Actor for Mercy, an Irish mobster film. And Sylvester Stallone, he won Worst Supporting Actor for the fourth Expendables film. So some big names, but you know what, it is a bit of fun. And a lot of people see it as a way to kind of burst a few egos.
Yeah, and in the old days, the actors used to try and turn up at the ceremony.
Yeah, so Halle Berry won a Razzie and she turned up to collect her Razzie with the Oscar that she'd won. Sandra Bullock, she won an Oscar and a Razzie and she turned up. Now it's very much online and a lot of people don't go to the event anymore, but it's still a lot of fun when you see these films, especially things like Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, doing so badly or so well, depending on your viewpoint.
Our culture reporter, Charlotte Gallagher. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we decided to include, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk or on X, we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Cazares. The producer was Alison Davis. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.